Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, July 16th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. First, we have the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, it'll be partly cloudy, the wind from light from the northwest. We'll have a high of 82, a low of 63. Tomorrow, Friday, we'll have a chance of rain, storms late in the day. We'll have a high of 87 and a low of 71. On Saturday, it'll be mostly sunny, high of 92 and a low of 73. And then on Sunday, a chance of rain and storms with a high of 89 and a low of 68. The normal high for this day is 86, the normal low 65. The record high was 104 in 1913. The record low was 49 in 2014. The sun will set tonight at 8:40. It will rise tomorrow at 5:46. We have a little weather story today, this one from meteorologist Justin Gertz. As we face the heat index climbing above 100 degrees Saturday, it might help to know that we haven't dealt with that yet this year. Through July 15th, Cedar Rapids has had an above-average number of hours with a heat index, but that's only part of the story. High heat indices have been less common than usual. On average, eastern Iowa would have had about 276 hours with a heat index of at least 80 degrees by now. This year, there have been 305. We've had 54 hours with a heat index of 90 or higher, 6 hours below the average. There hasn't been one of 100 or higher. The average is a little more than 7 hours. And that little weather story is from meteorologist Justin Gertz. And now we'll turn to the front page of today's Gazette. Our first story, this one is no surprise, is about the coronavirus. Mandatory masks start Monday at Walmart. Other stores are expected to follow America's largest retailer. The nation's largest retailer, Walmart, will require customers to wear face coverings inside all of its namesake and Sam's Club stores, a mandate that now may become more widely mimicked by other stores amid a COVID-19 spike, although it has proved difficult to enforce. Walmart said Wednesday that policy will take effect Monday to allow time to inform customers and train workers. Currently, about 65% of its more than 5,000 stores and clubs are located in areas where there already is some form of government mandate for face coverings, but not Iowa. According to Walmart, the company has 58 supercenters, 2 discount stores, and 9 Sam's Clubs in Iowa, employing nearly 17,000 people. While Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has asked Iowans to practice social distancing and mask wearing in public, she said she won't require it. Quote, "I trust Iowans. I believe in Iowans," she said Wednesday afternoon in a radio interview. "There's no way to enforce it. Most of the states or entities that have done that, they've actually gone so far as to say, we're not going to enforce it, so it's just kind of a feel-good. I wear one if I can't social distance, but I'm not going to mandate it." Arkansas-based Walmart joins a growing list of retailers filling the role of states and the federal government that have not issued mandates on an issue that has been highly politicized by President Donald Trump. Given Walmart's clout as the nation's largest retailer, its decision is expected to push others to issue similar mandates. Kohl's announced Wednesday that starting Monday, it also will require customers to wear masks inside its department stores. Kohl's said about 70% of its locations already were covered by government mask orders, although its 18 Iowa stores were not. Shortly after Walmart's announcement, supermarket chain Kroger said it too would follow suit starting July 22nd. Last week, Starbucks announced that customers who visit its company-owned cafe locations will be required to wear face coverings. The policies at Starbucks and also at Best Buy went into effect Wednesday. Only a handful of major retailers, including American Eagle, Outfitters, and Apple, have a mask mandate for customers for all stores. Costco Wholesale Club was one of the first major retailers to require face coverings for all customers at all stores. Home improvement store Menards also requires masks of its customers at all sites. The National Retailer Federation, the nation's largest retail trade group, said in a statement, it hopes Walmart's move will be a tipping point in this public health debate. Retailers have been hesitant to issue chain-wide mandates for fear of angering some customers. They also didn't want to have their workers play the role of enforcers. It already was difficult enough to get some customers to comply, even in the states that had the mandates. However, the recent surge of new virus cases, particularly in Florida, California, Texas, and Arizona, has left the stores with no choice, retail experts said. Quote, I think Walmart's decision will give cover to other retailers to require masks, said Michael Hicks, an economist at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. I applaud Walmart and others for stepping in. Brian Eshelman, a managing director in the retail practice at consultancy Alex Partners, noted that retailers needed to step in to reduce their own health risks and that having a virus case is disruptive. He said, quote, it's a business risk that they need to manage for the safety of employees and customers. Eshelman added that he thinks making shoppers comply with the mask protocols will be easier now that wearing masks is becoming more of the norm. Still, Walmart is taking no chances, making sure to have a new strategy in place to enforce the mask protocols. It said Wednesday it will create the role of health ambassador at its Walmart stores and will station them near the entrance to remind customers without masks of its new requirements. These workers, who will be wearing black polo shirts, will receive special training to help make sure the process is as smooth as possible for customers. Walmart said it's working on various options for customers who don't show up with a face mask. As for Sam's Club, employees at the entrance will follow the same process, with its members reminding them of its requirements to wear a face covering when shopping. Complimentary masks will be provided. Last week, the Retail Industry Leaders Association, which represents Walmart, Best Buy, and other major chains, publicized a letter it sent to governors to mandate store customers to wear face coverings. It said the hodgepodge of rules around the country has created confusion for shoppers, and that has contributed to conflict between customers and workers trying to enforce rules. The National Governors Association said last week its members are discussing the letter. Social media is full of videos capturing clashes between customers who are asked to wear masks and employees who are under orders to make sure people wear them. In May, authorities said a security guard at a Family Dollar store in Flint, Michigan, was shot and killed after telling a customer her child had to wear a face mask to enter the store. Now we have another story from the front page of today's Gazette, also COVID-related. Vote necessary to start Iowa City schools online. Students back to classrooms in October at the earliest. And this story is by Martha Duffy of the Gazette. Students in the Iowa City Community School District won't return to face-to-face learning until October 6th at the earliest. By then, the district's 14,000 students will have been out of the classroom more than 6 months. Since schools closed in mid-March to prevent spread of the coronavirus, positive cases of COVID-19 in Iowa have climbed, fallen slightly, and since mid-June, again increased. The uptick has been acutely felt in Johnson County, which includes Iowa City. Of the 36,036 Iowans who have tested positive for the disease, 1,507 of them were in Johnson County, according to state data updated Wednesday. The county has seen 29 consecutive days of double-digit increases of new cases. Before the local surge, Iowa City School Board President Sean Eystone said he and other members were leaning toward resuming at least some in-person classes when the school year begins August 24th. As case numbers changed, so did board members' minds, he said. An emotional school board Tuesday night approved the plan. Quote, "It was an extremely difficult decision because we know how much that decision will have negative consequences," Eystone said. "I don't know if it's the right decision, but I'm certain it's a necessary one at this point in time." A growing number of school districts across the country have opted out of resuming in-person classes as the start of the academic year approaches, despite pressure otherwise from President Donald Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. From San Diego to Nashville to Miami, school districts have said they will start the year teaching remotely, according to the New York Times. In Iowa, the Cedar Rapids Community School District has not yet decided if students and staff will return to classes virtually, in person, or in a hybrid setting. The district is offering a fully online program for middle and high school students. Des Moines Public Schools plan to give families a choice between 100% virtual learning and a hybrid model, according to the Des Moines Register. Iowa City's interim superintendent, Matt Degner, said Wednesday he empathized with families in his district who were fearful of exposing their children to the virus if schools reopen, as well as those desperate to resume their children's in-person education. Quote, "We know it isn't easy and will have cascading effects for how their families are able to operate," Degner said. "Ultimately, we do have the health and safety of the larger school community in mind. We do anticipate we will be on-site during the school year at some point. It's just not going to happen August 24th. What those public health metrics are that would indicate when it's safe to reopen classrooms will be determined in the next 2 weeks," Degner said. Plans for athletics and activities also have not been set. In the meantime, he said, remote classes this fall will be true online learning rather than emergency learning. When schools closed in mid-March, districts rushed to provide virtual classes to varying degrees of success. Iowa City's plans for off-site learning allow for students who receive special education services to be brought to school for support in accessing the online instruction and to provide direct services, according to school board documents. The district will concurrently offer a completely online learning program, which will not be interrupted by decisions to shift to a hybrid or in-person model for students for families who don't want to send their children to schools at all this school year. Johnson County public health officials have been working in tandem with school district officials as they decide how and when to bring students and staff back together, County Community Health Manager Sam Jarvis said. Officials are watching to see how university students returning to Iowa City will affect public health in the community, Jarvis said, especially as younger Iowans have driven the increase in cases in Johnson County this summer. Quote, "There's no one public health measure by itself that is going to fix all of this. It's a multi-pronged approach," Jarvis said. "We sound like a broken record, but it's all about the practices put together that can help us keep cases low. Staying home when you're ill, covering your cough, washing your hands, 6 feet of social distancing, and wearing a face covering in public. All of those together really help." Degner urged community members to adhere to the public health advice to quicken the opening of schools. Quote, "If we do that together, I think we'll get a better handle on our local area," he said, so we can be back at school. And I'll pause for a moment here for another story. Also from the front page of today's Gazette, we have this story. Dip in student aid filings signals trouble. Harbinger of enrollment drop should be of concern. And this story is by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Iowa is seeing a drop in the rate and number of high school seniors filing free applications for federal student aid for the upcoming school year, a probable consequence of COVID-19 and an indication some might be abandoning higher education plans for fall. Additionally, the percentage of college co-eds who already have federal aid and want to renew it next year also is down among eligible students, suggesting a low disproportionate number of low-income students might be choosing not to return to college in 2021. Quote, part of the decline in FAFSAs filed is likely due to COVID-19, according to an Iowa College Aid report made public Wednesday on free application for federal student aid filings. As of May 31st, about 19,000 public high school seniors had filed a FAFSA, down about 4% from the nearly 20,000 the previous year. That decline came even as senior enrollment grew 1% over the same period, the report noted. Quote, once students began their online high school educations as of March 16th, it became more difficult for high school counselors to help students file the FAFSA, according to the report. Additionally, high school seniors might have reconsidered their post-secondary plans given the growing concerns about the pandemic. Because applying for federal student aid is a key step in the college-going process for many, officials perceive it as paramount in Iowa's pursuit of getting 70% of its working-age population some form of post-secondary training by 2025. Quote, a drop in the rate or number of FAFSAs filed by high school seniors should be of concern to higher education advocates, the report advised. Iowa has experienced both. Behind the state's pursuit of more higher educated Iowans is a projected surge in jobs demanding as much. COVID-19 impeded progress on that. When Iowa's colleges and when Iowa's colleges and universities in March vacated their campuses and moved instruction online. Most campuses have stayed in the virtual realm this summer, although many are planning to bring students, faculty, and staff back using a hybrid model of instruction this fall. But with students airing concerns about the prospect of another swift shift to virtual-only learning, along with the loss of many traditional collegiate experiences, Iowa's public universities are flagging potential decreases in enrollment. The corresponding drop in tuition revenue will compound the tens of millions the campuses already have lost in their pandemic responses and from reduced state appropriations. Before last spring semester, Iowa's FAFSA rate had been climbing, increasing substantially from 2018-19 to the 2019-20 cycle. Applications for 2020-2021 again had been trending up until COVID-19 wiped out that progress. The impact was felt all across all higher education sectors in Iowa and nationally, as fewer completed the Common Aid application, which was required for all federal assistance, including Pell Grants and federal student loans. It typically is required for state and institutional financial aid as well. National surveys recently conducted of 2019-20 high school seniors corroborate the FAFSA decrease in that they show some students are reconsidering and possibly delaying post-secondary education. A March through May analysis from the Strata Education Network found 34% of Americans ages 18 to 64 have canceled or changed education plans, with 65% of the youngest ages 18 to 24 having done so. Quote, the most common change of plans is to cancel or delay enrollment, according to the Strata survey, which found 41% of those reporting plan changes were looking at cancellations and 22% at delays. But Iowa College Aid officials stressed the need for post-secondary training and degrees. Quote, given increased unemployment and potentially fewer job opportunities for high school graduates, we believe that higher education is still a good investment for both new high school graduates and current college students, even with anticipated changes in the college experience, the report said. The report found widening racial and income disparities among filers. For example, as the percentage of white students in high school increases, the percentage of seniors filing a FAFSA grows. But as the percentage of low socioeconomic students swells, FAFSA rates fall. Compared with their female, white, and higher income counterparts, males, minorities, and high school students from low-income families are less likely to file. Quote, over time, FAFSA filers in Iowa are coming from wealthier families, suggesting that more work is needed to address important equity gaps in FAFSA filing within high schools. According to Iowa College Aid, which has long reported shifting demographics in the state, including increasing minority and low-income residents. Addressing those needs, Iowa College Aid on Wednesday reaffirmed the commitment to redouble efforts this fall to encourage more high school seniors to apply for college financial aid. Ramped up, outreach will involve more virtual connections as COVID-19 continues to complicate in-person activities and opportunities. Quote, we are definitely doing more virtual outreach, like everyone, said Iowa College Aid spokeswoman Elizabeth Keast Cedrell. And with that, I'm looking at the Insight page of the Gazette now, and first up we have this Gazette editorial, Test Iowa is a Failure. On Tuesday, Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand released a report stating that the Test Iowa program violates state law by not reporting COVID-19 test results immediately to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Test Iowa is a partnership for COVID-19 testing between the state of Iowa and Nomi Health, a tech company based in Utah. Governor Kim Reynolds entered into the $26 million no-bid contract in April, and the program was launched April 21st. Similar programs are underway in Nebraska and Utah. Since Test Iowa began, the program has failed to attain its promise of efficient and accurate COVID-19 testing in the state. Reporting by the Gazette found problems with the equipment, the testing process, and delays in results. Reporting by the Salt Lake Tribune also has raised questions about the reliability of the tests. The auditor's report verifies reporting by the Gazette about a problem with Test Iowa equipment and outlines how, once the state hygienic lab processes the test, they are sent to two data companies, Domo and Qualtrics, which contract with Nomi Health before being sent to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The report concludes, quote, the reporting chain for Test Iowa results is contrary to law, takes apparently pointless risks, and exposes taxpayers to potential legal liabilities. The report added, the Test Iowa reporting system is illegal because the results are not reported immediately to the Iowa Department of Public Health, which Iowa Code 139A.3 requires. Included in the report is a reply to the auditor's office from the Attorney General's office, which notes that the delay is 3 to 10 hours, which the state considers timely reporting. But the auditor's report points out that there is absolutely no reason for this delay, and every delay is crucial in a pandemic when time is of the essence. Additionally, reporting by the Gazette and the Des Moines Register has shown that many Iowans have experienced significant delays in receiving their results. The auditor's report is just another in a long line of questions and concerns about the public-private partnership, which Reynolds entered into on the advice of actor Ashton Kutcher. The resulting partnership has been a quagmire of inadequate testing, all in the name of reopening the economy. But as the state has reopened, cases are rising, and it's clear that Test Iowa isn't up to the challenge of the pandemic. And again, that is the Gazette's editorial. And now we'll drop down the page a bit for community letters. And today we have just one letter, and this one is from Colleen Tobiasen of Cedar Rapids. Will we stand together after the pandemic is over? The COVID-19 virus is disproportionately affecting low-income citizens. We stand together echoes throughout our nation. Citizens volunteer their time and resources to support those in need. Will this support continue once a vaccine is available and the virus is contained? Or will we revert to pre-pandemic as long as it doesn't affect the attitudes? Will we value receiving higher returns in our retirement accounts over paying all workers a decent wage? Corporate profits over providing workers with safe working conditions, health, and pension benefits? Calling essential workers heroes is hollow rhetoric if we do not match our words with our actions. When we fail to pay our nursing home, health aides, daycare, sanitation, restaurant, and grocery store, production and supply chain workers what they should be paid, we fail to honor them with the respect and dignity they deserve. Everyone deserves economic dignity, to be paid a wage that enables them to buy food, housing, clothing, schooling for their children, save for emergencies, and have access and the means to obtain health care. Earning enough to support oneself and one's family is the first step to creating true equality in our democracy. Each of us faces a moral choice. Will I value my personal financial security over that of my fellow citizens? Or will I make choices that result in economic dignity for all? And again, that letter is from Colleen Tobiasen of Cedar Rapids. I'm going to pause here just a moment. And all right, you are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, July 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we have the short notices from Calamus. Dennis G. Starling, 74, died Tuesday, July 14th. Arrangements are with the Chapman Funeral Home of Clarence. From Cedar Rapids, Irene Frances Dietert, 100, died Wednesday, July 15th. Arrangements are with the Broche Chapel and the Ava Center of Cedar Rapids. From Hawkeye, Steve Bixler Story, 87, died Tuesday, July 14th. The arrangements are with the Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of West Union. From Kelowna, Barbara E. Miller, 85, died Wednesday, July 15th. Arrangements are with the Yoder Powell Funeral Home of Kelowna. From Manchester, Mary Michaels, 78, of Manchester, formerly of Central City, died Wednesday, July 15th. The arrangements are with the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City. From Volga, Joseph Aloysius Knipper, that's spelled K-N-I-P-P-E-R, 70, died Monday, July 13th. Arrangements are with the Leonard Miller Funeral Home and Crematory of Strawberry Point. From Winthrop, Eugene W. Buhr, that's spelled B-U-H-R, 73, died Tuesday, July 14th. Arrangements are with the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home of Olwine. Now we'll drop down the page for the longer notices. From Ainsworth, Nancy Karen Stewart, 80, of Ainsworth, died Tuesday, July 14th at Halcyon House in Washington. A drive-by visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday, July 19th at the Family Apple Orchard Inn at 508 Linden Street in Ainsworth. The body has been cremated and burial will be at a later date. Beatty Funeral Home is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Bill Poulson, that's spelled P-O-U-L-S-O-N, 62, passed away on Wednesday, June 10th. Private family service and burial will be at 6 p.m. July 17th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. From Blairstown, Janice A. Swick, 76, passed away peacefully on Monday, July 13th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, July 17th at Grace Lutheran Church in Blairstown, with the Reverend Jeffrey Sean Bacher officiating. Visitation will be held from noon until 1:45, also at the church on Friday. From Cedar Rapids, Kishon Vondale Allers, 19, passed away on Sunday, July 12th, in Cedar Rapids. A public visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 17th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel stateroom. Private family funeral service and burial will be at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Barbara Jean Sherman, 85, of Cedar Rapids, went to be with her Lord on Tuesday, July 14th, at 1:11 a.m. at Mercy Hospital, following a short but fierce battle with COVID-19. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, July 19th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will follow at 10:30 a.m. Monday, July 20th, at the funeral home. Burial will be at the Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. The family requests that all in attendance wear a mask and respect social distancing guidelines due to the COVID-19 pandemic. From Loudoun, Wilma G. Kruger, 91, of Loudoun, died July 11th at Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids. Private burial services will occur at Rock Island National Cemetery, where her husband, a U.S. Army veteran, is buried. From Jessup, Julia Ann Shares, or Sherries, that's spelled S-C-H-A-R-E-S, 86, of Jessup, Iowa, died Tuesday, July 14th, at Mercy One Covenant Medical Center in Waterloo, of natural causes. Family funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 18th, at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup. The Mass will be live-streamed for the public on the church website at www.sedaparish.com. Public graveside services are scheduled for 11:30 a.m. Saturday at St. Athanasius Catholic Cemetery in Jessup. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 17th, at White Funeral Home in Jessup, with the Catholic Daughters of America Rosary at 3 p.m. Friday. Masks and social distancing will be required. From Marion, Daryl E. Weber, 48, of Marion, passed away on Tuesday, July 14th, at his home. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, July 17th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. All guests are respectfully encouraged to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Interment will take place at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Manchester, David Wayne Lawson, 70, of Manchester, passed away at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday, June 17th, after a valiant fight against cancer. A celebration of his life will be at 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday, July 18th, at the Gathering Place in Manchester. A memorial service will be at 3 p.m. Saturday, July 18th, at the Gathering Place in Manchester. From Monticello, Lorraine Laurie Fritz, 90, died Tuesday at the Mercy Hospice House in Cedar Rapids, following a brief illness. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, July 18th, at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Monticello, with interment in the Oakwood Cemetery. Friends may call from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Goetsch Funeral Home in Monticello. Interment will be in the Oakwood Cemetery. Maxine, also known as Maxie Gardner Brickner, 73, of Newton, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, July 13th, at Mercy One Newton Medical Center. A private family service will be held. The family invites friends to join them for a celebration of Maxine's life, beginning at noon Saturday, July 18th, at the Newton American Legion. From North Liberty, Melody Ann Bakken, spelled B-A-K-K-E-N, 53, of North Liberty, passed away peacefully on May 7th at her home following a courageous battle with osteosarcoma. She was surrounded by her loving family. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, July 18th, at Lansing's Oak Hill 210 Holiday Road in Coralville, where a service and time of sharing will begin at 2 p.m. A memorial gathering for family and friends will follow the service until 5 p.m. Because of COVID-19, please respect wearing of masks and social distancing. In lieu of flowers, donations may be directed to the family to be distributed to organizations that were important to Melody. Those who are unable to attend the service in time of sharing at 2 p.m. may watch it via Zoom. Please visit www.lensingfuneralhome.com for instructions and details to attend the service using Zoom. And finally, from Shellsburg, Shirley Jensen, 87, passed away peacefully at the Vinton Lutheran Home on Tuesday, July 14th, from cancer. Private graveside services will be held at Oakwood Cemetery in Shellsburg. Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home is caring for Shirley and her family. And now we have a sports page of the Gazette and high school softball. Girls high school softball. Story under that heading is Speed Power. Number one, Northland has it all. Troy Mills. Lots of speed, a slam, and a quick night. Hannah Bridgewater contributed four of Northland's 16 stolen bases, then closed the show with a fourth-inning grand slam to lead the top-ranked Lynx past MFL Marmac 15-0 in a Class 2A softball regional quarterfinal last night at Northland High School. Quote, "We took care of business," Lynx coach Marv Porter said. "We love to run. We had some girls run today that hadn't run much before." The defending 2A state champion, North Lynn, at 21-0, won its 27th consecutive game and marched on to face Hudson, who defeated Dyke, New Hartford, 5-4 in 8 innings in a regional semifinal here at 7 p.m. Friday. No doubt about it, the Lynx are a juggernaut. They have outscored their competition by a 245-25 margin this season, and Wednesday's outcome was indicative of their completeness. Quote, "Up and down the lineup, everybody gets on a roll," said Bridgewater, who will play at Upper Iowa University next year. It's just a lot of fun. Bridgewater opened the game by walking on 4 pitches. She stole second base, stole third base, and scored when the throw sailed into left field. The Lynx were off and running and running and running. Said Bridgewater, quote, "When we steal bases, it makes it easier. You get those runners closer and the RBIs are easier. We did a lot of delayed steals, and that worked pretty well. As for the grand slam," said Bridgewater, quote, "it was right down the middle and I tried to get a good swing. I just wanted to hit it into the ground or in the air and get that 12th run in." She did a little more than that, lining it over the fence in left center field. Jill Smith, who added 3 RBIs, said the art of the stolen base is more than mere speed. Quote, "Some of us aren't that fast, but we're smart when we're on base and we know what we're doing," she said. "We had a lot of fun tonight. We're just playing ball. It doesn't feel like a job." Northland scored 3 times in the first inning, 6 in the second, all with 2 outs, once in the third, and 5 in the fourth. Bridgewater, Smith, and Jenna Lemley contributed 2 hits apiece. Abby Flanagan, at 13-0, pitched a 1-hitter, striking out 7. She surrendered 2 base runners. Grace Flanagan picked both of them off at first base. MFL Marmac retired at 11-6. I'll turn to the back page of today's Gazette, where we have the Dear Abby column. Indecision makes easy for an uneasy marriage. Dear Abby, I have been with my husband for 29 years, 25 of them married. We have had good times and bad, like most couples, but things have changed in the past 4 years. We both needed to decide whether we wanted to continue in our marriage. We went to counseling and I pursued new things to find happiness in my interests and career. My husband did the same thing. Now I have moved past it, forgiven, told my husband I love him, and hope he feels the same. but he said he needs more time. It already has been a long time, and it's upsetting to wait for him to make up his mind. If I become frustrated, he says, I don't have to stay. Trouble is, I want my husband, and I want him to want me back. What do I do? I take good care of myself and have a healthy sex drive. Sex happens rarely. He also had an emotional affair about 18 months ago with a woman he knows, but he thinks I made too much of it. Help, please. And this letter is signed Uncoupling in Canada. Dear Uncoupling, going off and being independent might have been the wrong path. Your husband appears to have disconnected from you physically and emotionally. When he went off and tried things he was interested in, the things he tried might have included the woman with whom he had the affair. Waiting for your husband to make up his mind might leave you in limbo for years. You're entitled to a happy life. Now might be the time to make one for yourself. And that is the Dear Abby column for today. Here's a story from the Living page of the Gazette. Find the thing you would do for free. Chef Anthony Green's passion are teaching and cooking. And this story is by Allison Goins of the Gazette. Even if he wasn't being paid, Anthony Green says he would still want to cook and to teach. An instructor at Kirkwood Community College, he said passing on his skills and love of cooking is his calling. He's taking his own advice. He tells his students they should find something they would do for free and make that their job. He said, quote, you don't do what you love, what you're passionate about, just for the money. Money pays the bill, but doesn't truly satisfy. I would do this for free. My wife wouldn't agree, he added with a laugh, but I would cook and teach for free. Green grew up in Jamaica, where he said he learned cooking from many members of his family, including his mother, grandmother, and aunt. Quote, cooking is a way of life where I come from, for both male and female. My mom was like, if you're going to eat well, you're going to learn to cook. So I learned from a young age, he said. A particular influence was his uncle, Berries, who would cook for family parties and neighborhood gatherings, sometimes for hundreds of people at a time. Quote, he was one of the chefs in the family. Whenever I would go visit that side of the family, there was always a celebration, there was always food, and there was always a lot of cooking. He said his family was poor and didn't have much, but when they would eat together, that didn't seem to matter. Quote, when we came together over a pot of food, it changed everything. It changed everybody's perception of the world. You could walk into the next day because you had a good time the night before. Along with his job at Kirkwood, he and his wife, Tanya Green, had started a company, Chef Green and Company, offering private cooking classes in people's homes. They put that on hiatus due to the coronavirus and have been focusing on another culinary venture instead, developing their own line of Jamaica seasonings and sauces. 2 months ago, they launched their first one, Uncle Berry's Jamaican Jerk Seasoning, which is named in honor of the uncle who taught him many of his cooking skills. Said Anthony Green, I want to use the product not only to teach people about Jamaican jerk, but also as a tribute to him and my family. He produces the seasoning in Lionbridge Brewing Company's kitchen, since he doesn't have a certified kitchen at home. And the seasoning is available for sale there, as well as through their website for local delivery. And that website is chefgreenandcompany.com. The Greens also sell it at the Mount Vernon Farmers Market from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursdays, and the Hiawatha Farmers Market from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sundays. Lion Bridge also is featuring it in a menu item, which is a jerk taco with Green's homemade banana barbecue sauce, and island slaw. Someday he hopes to expand to bottling and selling that barbecue sauce as well. In the meantime, he's worked with Lionbridge to offer a couple of pop-up Jamaican dinners in the last month. He and his partnership with the restaurant has been a good one. Quote, "I have to give thanks to Lionbridge," he said. "It's a wonderful thing about living in a small community like this. This business wouldn't have made it off the ground without the help of Lionbridge and people in the community. Everyone from my students, from Kirkwood, to parents on my son's sports team. It's great to give to the community, which as a teacher I've done, and to have it give back. His wife is originally from Iowa, which is how they ended up here. He first came to the United States to attend a culinary school in Nelsonville, Ohio, before moving to Florida, which is where the couple met. Tanya Green was stationed in the Florida Keys with the U.S. Coast Guard. She also attended culinary school, and the two ended up cooking at the same resort. They started a catering business together before moving to Iowa to raise their family. In Florida, he taught culinary classes at a high school for 4 years before moving to Iowa and teaching at Kirkwood's culinary art program. He said teaching, like cooking, is a way to share and connect with people. And he likes knowing what he teaches. I'll begin that sentence again. And he likes knowing what he teaches will ripple out as his students cook for others and share their skills. And with that, this session will come to an end. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Thursday, July 16th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
From From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall. And many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home. So take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors. And install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.